The news from this week about a major hack of personal information from Capital One Bank is just the latest warning about how hard it can be to control the facts of who we are. It gets really tricky online when people are offering things in exchange for just a few details about you. And it turns out it may not take many of those details to figure out who you are. Researchers recently published work about online anonymity and how easy it can be to figure out who you are from what and where you are. Sophie Bushwick wrote about the research in Scientific American, and she's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Sophie, welcome.
Thank you.
So tell us about the research you covered here.
So this is, in the past, researchers have sort of looked at in a specific set of supposedly anonymous data, and they've shown that they can re-identify specific individuals in that set. But what this paper was saying is, let's say you've got just any general database, what are the odds that we could identify someone even if their name or their email address wasn't attached? And what they found is that if you've got this random set, and it includes 15 demographic traits. So these are things like maybe it has a person's gender and their zip code and marital status. Well, in that case, there's a 99.98% for an American to be re-identified from that set of data.
Wow. So, and that's at 15% is kind of the sweet spot then, you're saying, or 15 different tidbits of information.
Well, you can also be re-identified with even fewer tidbits. So one kind of scary thing that the researchers have done is they've published this free online tool that you can use where you can they promise not to save your data if you put it in, but you can enter just 3 traits, your birthday, your gender, and your zip code, and it will tell you what your odds of being re-identified are. And for many people, that's an 83% chance. I actually use this tool myself, and I happen to live in a very high, a populous zip code. So my odds of being re-identified were only 34%, and I was feeling pretty good about myself. But then you can also see, does that number change if you add one more piece of information? So I updated this with my marital status, and all of a sudden my odds of being re-identified jumped to 97% from just 4 pieces of information.
Wow. I took the same test myself, and I do not live in a very populous zip code. There might be 5,000 households in the zip code, and so entering birth date, zip code, and gender told me I had a 92% chance of being identified just from those 3 bits of information.
Wow. Yeah.
So do most of us assume, Sophie, that by not giving key bits of information, like, for example, your name or your social security number, that we sort of settle in for this idea that we're anonymous online?
A lot of us do, but I think that a lot of people might not be aware of just how much of their data is going into the hands of data brokers. So, for example, there are companies that specialize in collecting medical data. So they might take your medical records, your name is not on it, your social security is not on it, but maybe sensitive health information is included in this, and then they'll bundle it in a set with a lot of other people's health data, and they'll sell it, or they'll give it to, for example, researchers. So on the one hand, this can be really valuable. So if you're trying to study what traits make someone more at risk of, say, heart disease, it's very helpful to have all these pieces of information, and you can use it to draw conclusions that could maybe help doctors treat people and warn people when they're at risk. But on the other hand, if this data set isn't anonymized enough, it can be used to take sensitive information about someone. That's actually exactly what happened in, I think, in 2016. Journalists had a set of an anonymized data set in Germany. It had included the information for 3 million citizens, and they re-identified politicians. So they knew they could find information about politicians' medical information.
Yikes. And I know from talking to researchers, particularly in California, using the California Health Survey, that it really helps to have health information from that large a body of people to be able to do their work. But what you're saying then is that you got to be careful about who's got your information, because people can backtrack it and do some cross-referencing and figure, oh, that's this person.
That's exactly the case. Yes. So it's just very important that the people who are distributing this information take steps before they give it out. It's not enough to do to just de-identify it, to just take away the names and maybe social security numbers, because someone can be identified from the other traits. So they have to use other techniques, such as you can introduce noise to the data set. You can add background information that kind of muddles things up. You can do something called sampling, which is where, let's say you have a data set of 100 people or 100,000 people, you might only release 1,000 people's information, because then if someone finds this and says, hey, this person in the set looks like my neighbor Bob, the people who own the data can have the plausible deniability of like, well, we don't even know if Bob is included in this data set. But the problem with that is that even that isn't always enough to successfully hide somebody in this data. So it's very important that the organizations that collect it test it before they distribute it. They should test it themselves to make sure they can't identify individuals from it before they start handing it out.
Sophie Bushwick is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a journalist with Scientific American. She recently covered research coming out of Europe that looked at anonymous information, or allegedly anonymous information, and it seems that by cross-referencing several bits of information, we can end up re-identifying the people whose identifying information is supposed to be stripped out. Questions, comments from you, welcome on the Jefferson Exchange. Our phone number here is 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Let's unmask the researchers here too, Sophie. It's Yves Alexandre de Montjoy at Imperial College London and Luc Rocher at Catholic University of Louvain in Belgium.
That's right.
And so, I mean, if they're looking at large amounts of data, they probably had to have large amounts of data available to them to be able to do this research, it sounds like.
Yes, they used they had 210 different databases of anonymous information that they used to develop this statistical model that let them estimate how easy it is to re-identify people.
So let's talk about those databases then, because I guess one of the primary questions that people might have is who's got my stuff? You know, how much of me is out there in the world in somebody's database, identified or not?
A whole lot. If you really wanted to be anonymous, you would have to give up your credit card, your cell phone, any use of the internet whatsoever, and you probably couldn't go to a hospital either, because there's databases of health information, there's databases of credit card spending, there's really, every time you browse online, there's databases of randomized anonymous people's browsing behavior. If you have a smart TV, it might be sending anonymous data to the people who make it, and then they might be distributing that and selling that to other parties. So this type of database isn't just useful for scientific research. It's also incredibly valuable for marketers or people who want to learn how to target ads or people who want to study consumer behavior. It's an industry worth hundreds of billions of dollars.
So basically everything we do that comes in contact with the internet is likely to be scattering some little breadcrumbs for someone.
Unfortunately, yes, that is the case. And as individuals, we have very little control over how that is used.
I'm particularly interested in the health information because, nobody particularly wants their health records out there. But you're saying that there are, and we have talked about this already, about the fact that there are some large bodies of information that is supposed to be anonymous about that connect with the effort being to sort of do a larger look at health in the population. But you're saying that sometimes this stuff can come back to us with oh, look, it's Bob from next door in your example.
Yes. If you have, you can think of these identifiers, it's sort of like if you've ever played the game Guess Who, and you're trying to narrow down who someone is, and you say, does this person have glasses? Does this person have a mustache? Is this person wearing a hat? And by the time you've knocked down everyone who doesn't match those, you've got a pretty good idea of who the person is. So it's the same thing if you've got all these, if you've got health data that also includes information about gender, birth date, the area where you live, it's pretty easy to figure out that, this is talking about Bob from next door, and it looks like Bob from next door has cancer, which is not something he might want to share with a random person looking at this database. So it's tricky because there are statistical methods that the people behind this data can use to kind of mask the identities of people, but they need to be testing it to make sure that they've achieved that goal before they distribute it. Or one thing that actually the researchers suggested was that the people who control the data would not just give it out in a lump. Instead, they would ask, they would say, okay, so if you are researching, say, kidney disease, then ask us specific information, like how many people who live in X area have kidney disease, and we'll give you the answer instead of just giving you the data and letting you find the answer.
All right, but it sounds like as people compile more and more information there are that many people who have access to information, and not everybody's going to have the same sense of ethics about how that's used.
That's absolutely the case. That's one of the reasons why people are suggesting we need regulations, we need laws that hold companies accountable if they don't do a good enough job of anonymizing the data that they use.
Sophie Bushwick, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a journalist with Scientific American. We're talking about research out of Europe that indicated that even if our information is online without our personal information about who we are attached to it, you can often use the bits of information that are present in the database to backtrack and figure out, in fact, who we are. Join us on the Exchange with questions, comments, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Morning, Jeffrey.
Howdy.
Well, a comment first. I like how Capital One has their tagline, their slogan. It's like, what's in your wallet?
Yeah, it sounds really bad this week.
I actually know probably more about what's in your wallet than you do.
That could well be. Well observed. Thanks for that.
Yeah, and that I like to ask the guests a question. This might sound a little twisted, but... is there a process by which you can use deductive reasoning by which if you put down that you're Mr., they assume that you're not a Ms. or a Mrs. or anything like that? In other words, by way of deductive reasoning, can they find out things about you by things that you don't volunteer over the Internet? I hope that makes sense, and I'll take the answer off the air.
All right. Thanks for that, Jamie. Appreciate it. Sophie?
I think that they can. I think the idea is if let's say they know 15 demographic traits about some anonymous person, they know how many cars this person owns, the marital status, how many times this person has been married, and how many kids they have, and the fact that they have two kids and that they're both boys. So based on that, they can say the only person who matches all of these things is John Smith, who lives in Northern Virginia and who we happen to know is a Mr. and is and owns a house worth so much money. So you could say, okay, you could combine those two pieces of information and cross-reference them to learn more about Mr. John Smith.
I want to encourage people to use that tool that we talked about earlier, and I want to be entirely clear that even though you are entering some information like your birth date, your zip code, your gender, it doesn't come back and say, Jeff, is that you? It's not that personal, but it's telling you what the odds are of you being identified. And you said it was like 33% for you originally, and then you added one more bit of data, and it jumped up?
That's right. When I entered my gender, birth date, and zip code, it said that there's a 34% chance that I could be identified in an anonymous database. And I think that's probably because I live in a zip code with a lot of people, which makes it likely that they wouldn't be sure if the person that they were looking at was really me. But then when I added my marital status, that number jumped up to 97% chance of being correctly identified.
Wow, that's an amazing change in circumstances there. So I have to ask before we go, Sophie, about the crossing of lines. I mean, we assume that, for example, we're not going to have information from health surveys or medical records sold off to marketers, but we might be being a little too charitable. I mean, do we get into realms where information that is sort of something that you provide to people because they need this information to help you ends up in the hands of people who just want to sell you stuff?
Well, I think in the case of marketing, often when you're talking about medical data, the place, the main place this is going is to researchers who are trying to figure out things about disease, as opposed to going to a marketing company who wants to sell kidney medication or something. But I think that often the main thing that's going to people who are trying to sell you things is probably information about the way people use their credit cards, databases that suggest shopping habits or that show your browsing history, because that can indicate your interests and what you might be interested in buying.
So I guess the question that most of us are going to ask at this point is the horse already out of the barn with no chance of getting it back?
I don't think that's necessarily the case. But I think that there's absolutely, if you use the internet and credit cards, and there's a chance that your data has been lost. We're always hearing about these big ticket breaches. You talked about Capital One is the most recent one to really make headlines about putting people's information out there. But I think that as we continue to generate more and more information, I think that the people who use this information should be held accountable and should be able to find better ways of hiding the identity of the people whose information they use. And if they can manage to do that, then there's no reason why this information can't be very useful and valuable and do good. But it needs to be balanced with protecting the consumers or the real humans whose information is being used.
So do we have any regulation really that deals with this in this country? I mean, Europe, I know, has a chance to essentially erase yourself from the internet. We have nothing like that in this country, though, right?
Well, California does have the California Consumer Privacy Act. But right now, I think there is a need for the U.S. to have some federal legislation about data privacy, and I think that there's definitely interest right now in Congress in passing legislation like that, but it actually nothing has passed thus far. Hopefully, studies like this can help inform the people who write these laws and help them figure out the best ways to protect the individuals who might not have as much power in this situation.
Sophie Bushwick has been our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a journalist working for Scientific American magazine. The piece we're referring to is in the July 23rd issue called Anonymous Data Won't Protect Your Identity, Anonymous in quote marks. There's also a pretty good piece about forest fires that Sophie wrote for Scientific American in June, worth looking at as well. We'll provide a link to the tool that we were talking about on our page at jeffexchange.org. Sophie Bushwick, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me.